You are listening to the Presence Podcast, episode number 6, The Awakened Heart of Awareness, with someone I've been looking forward to talking to for a very long time, Dr. Michael Sapiro. I'm your host, Ken Sullivan, and show notes and other presence-related episodes can be found at presencepodcast.com. And if you're searching for Presence Podcast online, make sure to search Presence Podcast Ken Sullivan, and Ken is with two N's, K-E-N-N. You can also follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. All right, so let's dive into this awesome interview and find out what the present moment has in store for us. Okay, Michael, so why don't we just get started by you going ahead and telling us about your setting that you're in right now, just kind of set the stage, and then let's dive into the rest of the episode.
Sure. So I'm in Boise, Idaho, in my office right now, which is in the north end of Boise, really nice historic area of our city, and I'm in my quiet office. The house was built, I think, early 1900s, and so I'm looking out at awesome trees and surrounded in the office of dark wood and built-in cabinets and a lot of pictures of my teachers and books. Well, it's nice, quiet here.
Gorgeous. Sounds awesome. It's a very rainy day where I'm at here in Utah, and the trees are soaking it all up.
We had a lot of rain.
The blossoms
here.
Going on. Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. Well, I'm super excited for this episode today. I've wanted to have this kind of conversation with you for a long time now. Why don't we get started by you just giving a brief background and your pedigree, and just let us know who we're talking to before I start asking you some questions.
Yeah, wonderful. So I'm a clinical psychologist, have a PsyD, a doctorate in clinical psychology. And I'm an integrative psychologist. What that means to me and to my patients is that I integrate a variety of perspectives and practices. So we have the Western clinical psychology, understanding the mind and cognition, function, also disorders, clinical disorders. And I'm also integrating Buddhist Dharma. So I've had 22 years of training in Buddhism, 8 years in Zen, and about 15 in Theravada Buddhism. And so my work is heavily influenced by the Buddhist teachings. And I often use those as what I call medicine for disorders of the mind or issues of the mind. So if there's grasping, aversion, contention, hatred, anger, there's always a medicine that the Dharma can refer us to practicing. I integrate science, specifically noetic sciences, the science of consciousness, the science of knowing, not just intellectually knowing, but the felt experience of knowing. So I integrate sciences that come out of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and various institutes around the world looking at consciousness and transformation. I integrate non-dual awareness, so I've been studying non-dual meditation in a lineage called Kashmir Shaivism for quite some time, and that becomes integrated as well. And so my practice really integrates meditation, mindfulness, the Dharma in terms of how do we actually handle ourselves in the world and watch our speech and our behavior and our actions, and then I integrate psychology altogether for the patient in hopes in favor of awakening, really personal awakening, so that we can contribute to collective transformation.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, there's a lot to cover there.
There is, yeah. I do. The podcasts I do really kind of sometimes break those apart into different sections.
Yes, and I want to do that too. So for our listeners, will you quickly summarize how you define Buddhism and also duality versus non-duality as a brief foundation for the rest of this episode?
Wonderful, sure. So, you know, Buddhism in the West and East is different, but it's all the same also because it leads to the ending or the reducing of our suffering, really helping us see where suffering arises and our craving for something or aversion from something. I was trained in Zen formally for 8 years, and that comes out of Japan as Buddhism traveled through East Asia, it picked up various cultural pieces, and Zen is Japanese Buddhism. And then I moved to Thailand 15 years ago for the Peace Corps, or maybe it was 14 years ago, and I had formal permission to switch from Zen to Theravada Buddhism, which is where Jack Kornfield, James Beres, Joseph Goldstein, these guys have come out of the tradition of the Thai forest Buddhism. And I trained formally with Thai teachers. I spoke the language and became a monk over there for some time. And now I study with James Beres, who's out of Berkeley, and Spirit Rock out of California. So Buddhism really informs, how do we refine ourselves, our human self? How do we let go of grasping? How do we work on aversion, anger? How do we work on craving? And to see ourselves very clearly. That's how I use Buddhism. And it's a daily mindfulness practice. There can be contemplative practices, concentration practices. The Buddha gave us quite a different variety of meditation practices, really to soothe the yearning heart, to soothe the angry mind or the craving mind, so that we find deep peace in just being. And then we switch over to duality and non-duality. Duality suggests that you have to do something to attain another state, that you have to go through kind of a process of transformation to get to a certain state of transformation or transcendence. Non-duality kind of presupposes that it's already right here. Everything you're seeking, that state of being, peace, and ease, is already found right here in the moment, and there's no doing needed. But we also hold that there is a process of unfolding at the same time, because duality can be held in non-duality, but duality can't hold non-duality. Duality says it's this or that. Non-duality says it's this and that. So when I use this clinically with people, there is a process of unfolding, but what I also bring them to is a really felt sense of ease and well-being that exists right here in the present moment.
Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. Yes, in my experience, I have discovered that, although I don't really understand it all intellectually as much as I do experientially. That's what I wanted to dive into with you, is talking about your experiences. Why don't we go, before we do that real quickly also, touch on maybe the religion that people call Buddhism versus the way you're defining it.
Well, Buddha himself called this a science of mind. It's an experiment. He said, try this on. He said, watch yourself for a certain period of time. Watch what comes up in your mind. Also what comes up in the body. Where are you attached to what comes up? How do you identify with what comes up? He was very clear that this is a scientific practice of exploring the present moment and the various ways we attach to what's arising or turn away from it. What happened culturally is that as Buddhism spread throughout Tibet, China, through Eastern Asia, and then also down through the Southeast Asia of Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, it picked up and it got fused with the kind of animistic or spiritual traditions of those countries. And so it was seen as religious because it was fused with the religions of those countries. So it became hard to tease out, isn't Buddhism a religion? Well, no, it's a practice, a way of being. The Buddha set up as a science of mind that then became fused with local religions as it passed through. So Taoism became fused with Buddhism, became Chan. And in Japanese, Shintoism and Buddhism fused to become Zen. And so people consider it a religion, and those countries do have religious practices, bowing bells, chanting, singing deities. But like in the Vedic traditions or what we call Hindu traditions, all of that's a representation of parts of ourselves. There isn't anything outside of ourselves. Any Hindu god or deity really represents an aspect of ourself, an archetype, we could say, that really comes forward in different times of our life. So I don't think of it as a religion, as more of a real spiritual human practice that we engage ourselves in. So I guess I'll just set the stage that way for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. Thank you so much. I really liked hearing you,
well, thank you,
explain it like that. I would love to hear about some of your experiences, Michael, about your own personal transformations, your own life lessons, your ahas, call it whatever you want to, and the experiences of any others that you feel our listeners would have interest in as it pertains to the present moment. I mean, what does the present moment hold in store for us?
Oh, man, I would like to start there, actually, because for those listening, I think the most important piece that I can share, and we can look at it from a variety of lenses. I have Christian patients who are seeking the presence of God in their life, and I have Buddhist patients who are seeking a kind of a relief of their own suffering and just being present in life itself. And then I have agnostic atheist people working with me looking for just ease and well-being. So no matter who comes to me, my agenda isn't set on trying to make them Buddhist or non-dual. That wouldn't work as a psychologist or as a teacher, but really leading them to what their heart most desires for them. And so The true experience of God or divinity or life or the universe living through us can be felt only in the present moment. And our bodies are the vehicles in which we feel the expression of life living itself, where we feel the presence of God, not as a concept, but as a lived experience in our own bodies. And then surrounding us through awareness. Awareness is that container in which our body sensations are felt. So you could feel this presence in your actual body and then also in the surrounding field of awareness. And so the present moment contains life unfolding. And that is what most people are searching for because it naturally brings a sense of well-being and ease. And I'm even saying that for the most traumatized of my patients who have been through severe torture and trauma can find well-being and ease just in this very moment. And that's the only place it exists. So, and most people dissociate from their bodies. They're thinking heads like balloons, helium balloons. And they're holding on to these ideas of theirs as if they're true, pulling themselves out of their bodies, which in fact, the body is the only way we can experience anything through sensation. So the present moment is the actual place where we find what we're looking for.
Okay, excellent. So so what was your first experience like, or a prominent experience for you when you first realized that you're right in the present moment?
LSD when I was 15, without a doubt.
Interesting.
Totally started
off. Go ahead. Go ahead and talk about that.
Well, I mean, I started smoking weed when I was 12. It was a way to connect with people and regulate my anxiety and some anger. I didn't have the skills I needed. And so, of course, I turned to external medicine or drugs and then tried LSD. And at first, it was extremely frightening for a 15-year-old brain to have experiences of the universe outside of itself. It was a huge shift for me. And then as I would try other psychedelics as a teen, I actually started having experiences of the universe flowing through me and me being a vessel for the universe flowing through me rather than Mike just having experience of himself in the universe. I really became the vehicle for which the universe was expressing itself. And I had that as a very young person and then was seeking that. What is this? And I was wise enough to know drugs isn't the way I need to do it because I liked learning. I liked having a clear mind and I didn't want to be reliant on any one particular external kind of source of transformation.
Aiding you to get there.
Yeah. And so, you know, at 18, I was like, what else is there that speaks this language, but that's internal? And I actually found a Taoist teacher, but that didn't quite hit for me. It wasn't quite the right flavor. It was so very peaceful, and I'm like, came from a Holocaust surviving Jewish family. I'm like, that's too soft for me. I need something a little bit more, you know, real about this shit kind of sucks, because that's what it felt like growing up. Like, life, you know, and Buddhism really spoke my language. So I found that, and then had experiences of deep meditation with teachers, even in my late teenage years, early 20s. And I found teachers, and I sat long courses. And it started to have the dissolving of the self. I clearly saw the battle of my mind, the inner critic. One of the most transformational experiences was in Oregon with Jan Bays, Chosen Bays, one of my Zen teachers, out of Great Vow Zen Monastery in Klatskanai, Oregon. She had invited a Thai teacher, Ajahn Amaro, to come sit for a week and teach us about becoming friends with our emotions and our inner critic. And I would listen to my inner critic just berate me. It was such an asshole, really. My inner critic was so hard on myself. And, you know, anybody who's listening is like, oh, totally. My voice is so hard on myself. And I was like, you know, how do I make friends with this? Well, there's a certain need it has. And to be honest, it is really wise what it's sharing. It's just very unskillful at how it's sharing it. And I had this moment where I told it, I was like, you know, what do you want? He's like, I just want you to be safe. And I'm like, I want to be safe too. Is there a way you can talk to me without such animosity? Because it hurts. And he goes, you won't listen. You have to be yelled at. I'm like, no, actually, I will listen. I want to learn from my inner wisdom. I just can't have you talking to me like that. And that was, I was like 24 years old. And I have a very strong inner guide who is critical of myself without being hateful or contentious. And I can listen to it now because I'm like, it's like, dude, don't do that. That's going to really hurt. That's going to hurt others. And I'm like, thank you. You know, I might still do it and take the consequence, but I'm so much kinder to myself because I was able to sit with myself and turn that voice from an adversary into an ally.
Oh my. So I think a lot of us can relate to that. For me, becoming increasingly aware has given me this heightened sense of realizing my impact, positive or negative, if you want to call it that, but just the noticing of what that impact actually is. It's a huge thing to start to internalize.
Totally.
Wow, totally. I'm actually causing a lot of things to happen, and my actions actually seem to ripple out.
We're actually purposefully creating our reality, but it's subconsciously being done. Our subconscious is purposefully recreating a reality based on our habits and mental conditions that we are unaware of, thinking, why is it like this? Why are people talking to me like that? Why do I engage in harmful behaviors or in unskillful relationships? Because there's a subconscious or unconscious process in place that is actually putting us in direct contact with people who treat us a certain way. And when or we choose behaviors we're not even aware of doing until we see the impact or result, and we're like, oh, shoot, I did it again. Or we might not even be aware and just blame the world. It always happens to me. But when we slow down, we expand our awareness, and we really witness ourselves working before we act, we see the machinery and mechanism of our mind creating a reality for ourselves. And then we can go, I don't want to choose that anymore. I want to choose this instead. And now we start intentionally, consciously creating a path for ourselves.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Beautiful. Instead of acting like life's just happening to us.
Totally.
Like I spent the first four and a half decades of my life doing. Have you seen that TED Talk from Anil Seth? A really popular TED Talk on how we are hallucinating our conscious reality.
No, I haven't. I haven't. Mm-mm.
Yeah, he gets into the science. He's a neuroscientist that gets into the science of it. And it's fascinating just how our brains are processing information and how all of us are hallucinating. And it's when we all agree on the hallucinations that we call it reality. he articulates it so well.
Yeah, Joe Dispenza has a really beautiful book called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. And I recommend this to most of my patients when they're at a certain place of being able to now start co-creating or cultivating the life they want. It takes a while for us to get there through. We have to regulate our bodies. We have to make sure we're safe. And when we're really in a place of like, hey, I'm ready to create a life now. I see that I'm creating this life that I don't really want to participate in anymore in this way. How can I start creating or co-creating or cultivating a way of being or a life that's more aligned with my deepest values? And I really like Joe's work because he kind of gives a pathway for saying, here's one way of visualizing a future that you never thought before. And then you start living into that future. And I do similar work like that, helping people see a future that was before inconceivable. Now they can conceive it and see it. And so how do you start living into that future? By being different, by thinking, acting, speaking differently as the person would in the future. And I actually might be doing a course at Esalen next year on that. I'm waiting to see if it got approved, about really creating this version of yourself that will create a new future for yourself.
Yeah, so aren't you going to be doing a chapter for Deepak Chopra, The Awakened Heart of Awareness is going to be a chapter in one of his books?
I believe so. So I was just invited there. Deepak Chopra and my colleague and friend Paul Mills, who's the director of research at Chopra Foundation, I think they're trying, their intention is to bring non-dual awareness into the integrated health field. Because those of us who work with awareness know that it's immediate healing. Because when you're in the field of awareness, nothing is broken. Everything is whole. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't that be where we want to start from? And so they invited me to write a chapter. We're just waiting to hear from the publisher. You know, there's a whole process of writing books. And so my contribution was essentially the clinical application of non-dual awareness, which is kind of what we're talking about in a sense. You know, that space of not, that space of where it's everything happening. All your sensations, thoughts, beliefs, but you're not hooked on to any one of them. Not one of those takes you away from ease and being, because you're just witnessing it in from a place of ease. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I know that we've got a hard stop. You've got something coming up here right away, but I want to make sure that you have a chance. There's plenty of things that we could dive into, and we could have so many more conversations, which I don't think this will be our last conversation, but I'd like to know, here you are, you've got a voice, you've got, you're the only one who's had your experiences, you've got the entire world listening as your mic, with your mic right now. I mean, what would you like to say? What are you most passionate about? What haven't I asked you yet that you'd like to say?
I think I don't know most important. I know a really important piece in my work is leading people to love themselves. Truly love themselves so they feel safe. It's very hard to do this work of transformation and growing if you can't trust yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Once you learn that you're safe with yourself, then you start trying new things because you know you have your own back. You're accountable. You'll do the things you're saying you're going to do. This takes dedication and discipline to your own well-being. And once you know you're safe with yourself, like deeply safe in your body, you have your back, you have your best interest in mind, for the most part, you follow through, you take care of yourself, then you can rest. It's very hard to change habits when you're not rested, really deeply rested. I mean, in a sense of well-being and ease in your own body. It doesn't mean you're not anxious or your trauma responses don't come out or depression doesn't arise, but it means you have yourself when it does. That you have yourself in a deep way and you love yourself for who you are and for whatever arises, because that love is the most nurturing medicine of all.
I agree so much. It's been my biggest discovery that the love that I was always thinking was going to come from some external thing is already all in me and blossoms from the inside out. Just diving deep down in there, you find out that love only exists in the present. And it's where all the joy is. It's where all the balance is. It's where all the peace of mind is. It's all the fulfillment. It's where we feel safe. It's the only true place that I found to feel safe.
And when we feel that deeply in our body, we fuse that into our human experience of pain and suffering. So when my trauma responses arise, it's met with love. When my anxiety, which I have a lot of, arises, it's met with love. And so now I'm having an experience of anxiety being held in love.
Oh, yes. Oh, we could have an entire episode just on that.
Let's do it. That'd be our next
one. That's good stuff. Let's do it. I want to schedule something else with you. We have not covered nearly enough. Michael, I want to talk to you more and more and more. Thinking of everybody that you know of, who else should I talk to? I mean, here we are talking about presence. Who else should I talk to?
I mean, I would have a list that would go on forever. There are so many friends and colleagues in the field doing incredible work. Cassandra Wheaton is on the forefront of consciousness and change science. Daniel Ellenberg does work with men on resiliency and emotional resiliency, self-compassion. You know, then you have the big names like Richard Miller working in the non-dual yoga nidra, eye rest mm-hmm. yoga nidra. I mean, there are so many people doing really important work for health, healing, well-being, awakening, and transformation. It's really endless. We're very lucky as humans that we have people who are dedicated to the well-being of all of us. It's just, it warms me up. I feel deeply grateful. So, you know, when we're offline, I'll give you a whole list of names, you know?
You're awesome. You're so awesome. I am super grateful that we've had this chance so far to dive into this. And let's get on again soon, Michael.
Awesome.
I'm looking forward to
it very much.
Thank
you so much for having me on. And I hope your listeners had a sense of just excitement, curiosity, and maybe even some peace listening.
You're awesome, Michael. Thank you so much. I'm so glad we did this.
You're welcome. Thank you. Take good care.
Those who know me best know that lately in my life, I'm always looking for additional truth, and I'd love to hear about your experiences and any ideas that you have for helping this podcast reach as far and wide as possible. And if you've liked what you've heard about presence, will you go ahead and take a moment right now and share with those that you feel may be receptive to connecting as well? Please reach out if you're interested in helping yourself or your organization benefit by attending an upcoming Surrender Lab session or retreat, or if you're interested in knowing how you may be able to help support the cause of presence in any way, please send an email to ken@ken.me, that's ken@ken.me, or you can also go to presencepodcast.com. You can also click on the donate button if you'd like to help with our goal here, to spread the cause as far and wide as we collectively care to make it go, and I can promise you that every single ounce of your support will be put to very good use. I'll see you again, amigo, right here, right now. I'm very grateful for you, and I hope your present moment is absolutely beautiful. Love, truth, and beauty transcend all of our head stories. It is always now. We are more than we think, and love can only be felt with your presence.